Welcome to A Piece of My Mind, a project that uses storytelling and art to rediscover what connects us. I'm John Noldner, the founder and director of A Piece of My Mind, and I have the good luck to travel the country and the world photographing people to reveal the beauty and wisdom that's all around us, if we choose to see it. This new season is called Still Here, and for these stories, we traveled to coastal Louisiana. During our 9 days in the state, we heard a lot about disappearance. Not only are marshes and barrier islands vanishing, but so is black-owned farmland. So are the livelihoods of shrimpers and the tradition of eating Gulf seafood. So are local grocery stores, neighborhood music clubs, affordable houses. And yet, we met people who were planting their stakes in this marshy ground saying, "We're still here. We're not going away. This place is too precious to abandon." Their hard work and the work of others like them is key to the survival of the lower 48's most fragile coastline and a model for the rest of the country. Thanks for tuning in to listen to their stories. For this series, we're partnering with longtime friend and journalist Barry Yeoman. Based in North Carolina, Barry has lived and worked in Louisiana and has written extensively about the complexities of culture, environment, and economy along the state's coastline. It's his voice you'll hear leading the interviews.
First of all, I just have to say that I'm just so happy about being here. We've been talking on and off for about a year and a half. And last night was the first time that I was actually in your physical presence.
Yeah, it was great to see y'all roll in. And it's good to have you here in my home. And yeah, you know, dive into some things. I think we have some similar thought processes in our heads. So
absolutely.
Cool to explore.
If I could have you introduce yourself, who are you and where are we?
My name is Bruce Sunpire Barnes. We are right in the armpit of the universe in New Orleans, Louisiana, uptown in the middle of the city, basically in a neighborhood called Broadmoor. This is an old area that was once called Redfish Lake. And so right in the center of the city, everything is basically 10 minutes one direction or the other.
And if I knew nothing about you, what would the first thing that you would want me to know about you?
Well, I am one of many siblings. I'm the 10th child of Willie Barnes, Sr., Indiana Barnes. My folks are all from some rural communities. My mother's from a little place called Arkansas City, down in southeast Arkansas. She was born out on an oxbow on the Mississippi River in a place called Seven Devils Swamp. And my father's from a little small town in northern Louisiana called Bayou Bonite, out in the middle of the Cypress Swamp. I was just there about 3 days ago, as a matter of fact. I have a bunch of brothers and sisters, and we all grew up in a pretty rural area in Benton, Arkansas, and which was outside of the city limits when we were growing up there, but it's called Gravel Hill or Benton, Arkansas. And so I've been, you know, existing in on this planet and in this universe, kind of in the pecking order that I was born and raised in. And that's just how it goes in the Deep South. And we're here in New Orleans now. And some of those similar things are all what the city's composed of. A lot of people who were either born in the city or came out of the Delta and from other places. It's all associated with water.
So tell me about Little Sunpie. Who were you? Who were you?
How'd you find this out? Well, I had my favorite aunt, Fanny Bradshaw, my father's oldest sister, lives up in Bastrop, Louisiana. And she and my uncle, Sunpie, that was one of our favorite places to go and visit. We were kids, and they were just like, she didn't have any children. So she would ask my father, she would say, "Hey, Red," called him Red, they called him Bud also. "Give me those three right there for the summer." I'm like, "What? For the whole summer?" "Yeah, I want those three." And if you went to visit them, I mean, she would put you to work, and she always had something for you to do. She raised turkeys, geese, chickens, they had pigs, you know, typical stuff that we had, but she was also a taskmaster. So so she would put you to work. But my favorite uncle, Sun Pai, was a piano player. That was her husband. And he was really a neat guy. He had these three fingers right here cut off. He worked in a sawmill, you know, running them boards of cypress and pine. And he got these three fingers cut off. So he still played piano, though. It didn't stop him at all from doing what he's doing. He'd be playing with these nubs, would be flying. And I just loved that. I thought it was some magical stuff going on. He and my father and other people in our neighborhood would get together and they played blues all night long during holidays or whatever event brought them together. And so she started calling me Little Sun Pie because I would follow him around, you know, like a little duck. And he was an interesting character to me. He had no hair on his face. And his mother was Blackfoot. And so, like Native American, but not the Blackfoot that's up in northern, you know, U.S. and Canada. This is a name that was tagged by French explorers when they came in and they encountered Native American people with very dark skin.
So really early on, you grew up in a crucible of music.
Yeah, didn't really think of it that much. It was just like it was what it was, but that kind of music, the music in the church that we went to, a couple of different churches, Baptist church and Pentecostal church, all about music.
At the same time, you grew up surrounded by nature.
Yeah, that wasn't not a choice, but it was a, you know, when you grew up in the woods, you know, Arkansas is a pretty rural place, and Louisiana, you know, like around New Orleans, you can go, it's one of those cities. It's not a big city, but it's compared to other places. But definitely within 10 or 15 minutes, you're outside of this metropolis and deep into nature and in swamps and wetlands. And you can forget all about the city practically immediately. Or if you're on the edge of it, not even know it's there.
So as you were coming up, what was your relationship to the critters and the trees, and how did the naturalist in you start growing?
Well, we as children, my playground was the woods and that surrounded us. So me and some of my brothers and cousins, first of all, my oldest brother had 10 children. They're all the same exact ages as me. My oldest sister had 10 children, all in the same age category. The sister next to them had 10 children. So we were all raised up within a half a mile of each other. And my grandparents had 13 children. So uniformly, there were like close to 50 of us in school at the same time. And these are small schools in a, you know, pretty rural, small place. So we played in the woods constantly, you know, and we had livestock like hogs, chickens, rabbits, everything. But my playground as a child growing up and all of my siblings and cousins and nieces and nephews was we ran through the woods all day as long as we could until they came and got us or they would send somebody to come and find us. So that was how I really fell in love with nature. And we bird hunted a lot. So we ate everything that we bird hunted. But first, one of the wonderful gifts that would happen was our parents gave us these World Book Encyclopedias. So we'd look up all of the birds, what species they were, and then we'd cook them and eat them. And one day, we were bird hunting, and this policeman rolled around he seen us on the edge of the woods coming out, and he was like, "Hey, what are y'all doing with those pellet guns?" And we said, "Oh, we're bird hunting." And he said, "Bird hunting?" He said, "Let me see what you got." And so he looked, and we had some robins and, you know, a couple of metal arcs and some different stuff. And he said, "Hey, you know, it's against the law to eat those birds. Those are songbirds." And we said, "Songbirds? We're like, man, these birds don't sing. Now, if you want to hear birds sing, you know, check out a mockingbird or something." So we started naming all the other birds that were like, you know, truly songbirds to us. And they were like, "What? Songbirds?" So, you know, that was a hilarious moment. But that's how we, you know, that's how we kind of informed ourselves about what was in the world, was through the encyclopedia. And I was very much into catching snakes. I was crazy about snakes. So I lost a few snakes in the house that my mother found in her mixing bowl, like my black rat snake that had been lost for about 7 or 8 months. And one morning she came in with a broom and she's like poking me. I'm in the bed sleeping. She doesn't say anything. She just like points and marches me in the kitchen, in the cabinet. And I'm like, open. I'm like, what? And then, you know, in her mixing bowl was a snake. It was twice the size it was when I first caught it too. And I was like, oh, you found my rat snake. And she was like, get that thing out of here. And so I was like, you know, she was like, out the house with it. So, but, you know, we had lots of stuff like that all the time.
I love that rat snake story. Yeah. So all of this, you know, for a lot of kids, it might have been just their hobby as a kid or just how they played, but it really shaped who you became.
Yeah, for me, I was always dead serious about it. And, you know, we had a few channels back in the day. I think there were probably three channels, and my favorite ones were like the ones around nature, of course, you know, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. I was about it, you know, Jacques Cousteau. So those were the, like the, that was my dual identity around a career. And, you know, I was out working in the woods, falling trees when I was in high school. I had a job, you know, cutting trees by hand. I was about 16 years old, and I'm thinking, like, what am I going to do with my life? And I love being in the woods, but I don't want to keep cutting trees. Like, I do want to, like, work in nature, but that wasn't it. So I decided I would study, you know, wildlife biology, and I wanted to study fish in particular because I had a plan to work with Jacques Cousteau. So I was like, I can do this. And I went off to university. I was an athlete when I was a kid, you know, like we all were, but I decided, okay, that's my ticket. I need to get this scholarship so I can, you know, I can run my plan on being on the Calypso. I'm going to do it. And it was foolproof for quite a long while, except I had one. I mean, I did it all. I took a 24-month scuba diving course, night diving, everything, cave diving, craziest, ridiculous stuff, open water diving, advanced open water. And I went to this particular university because they were crazy enough to listen to what I was saying. I had a football scholarship, and most of the universities I would go to were just like, oh, no, you need to study social science or, you know, go into there, you know. It was either accounting or social studies or so. I was like, that's not me. So I think I had maybe 53 scholarship offers when I was coming out of high school. And I went to all these universities. A lot of them were like large universities. And I decided it was too many distractions. Like they didn't see me as a person. They saw me as at least not the person that I thought I was and I wanted to become. They had other ideas around athletics, and that was cool. And I was like, I'll do my job, but I'm really trying to get to study fish. So Henderson State University, I went there, and that's out in southeast Arkansas. And so when I went there to, you know, check out the school, the coach of the football team, I thought I was going to see him, and he said, no, you need to go and talk to the president of the university. That's who you need to talk to. So,
wow.
He was like, go over and talk to him first. So I did. I went in, knocked on his door, and he was in his office and sat there and talked with him for about 2.5 hours or so. And he took me around the campus and he took me over to the biology department. And I was like, okay, I think I'm in the right spot now. He kind of sealed the deal when he took me over there and introduced me to everybody in the department, and I met the guy that was kind of going to shape my career around studying fish, you know, Kelly Oliver. So that's where I settled in at. And I was doing good with my plan, except, you know, Jacques Cousteau was like 88 years old, and he up and died on me. And I was like, oh. And then Marlon Perkins passed away. He was in deep in his 80s also. So I was like, oh, this is not good, bro. Got to figure something out. So, lo and behold, the National Park Service was available. So I started working in something called Cooperative Education Program with the National Park Service, Buffalo National River up in the Ozarks. It just so happens they did have the head of resource management was finishing up his PhD, a guy named Keith Wesnett, and he was studying darters and the river drainages around the Buffalo River. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm in now. So I'll go ahead and be a park ranger.
What was it like being in the woods in that role? That's sort of the first glimpse of your future.
It was interesting. I was in northern Arkansas, a place I hadn't really spent any time at, but it was in Ozark Mountains, you know, a lot of great drainages, limestone, caves everywhere. Started giving canoe tours on Buffalo River, you know. It was like this time of year in July, you know, floating down the river and taking people on about an eight-mile float trip and some rapids and different stuff like that. And then I was like, it's very different. There was all kinds of things going on the Buffalo River. So it was a very vibrant, wild national park that had some of everything. You know, they had a climb team, which I joined. We had a lot of incident command going on because there were always accidents and things going on. So the dive team, going in caves, cave rescue, rappelling. The climb team for, you know, people who were having accidents on the different various sides of the mountain, and they were doing and trying everything. So all these things were like, you know, a part of like what a park ranger was doing at the time. Giving cave tours, pretty, you know, like 5-6 hour hike into a wild cave. All those things were going on at the same time. And it was a pretty wild environment also. It was, in fact, the guy who hired me said, first thing he told me was like, well, I don't know if you've been in northern Arkansas, but it's lily white. I don't know if you're going to be. I said, it's what? He said, it's lily white. And I said, explain that to me. So he's like, do I need to explain? I was like, well, you know, explain it. So he did. And I was like, I was kind of smiling. I said, man, I'm going to be a park ranger. I don't care where it is. I'll walk through it, you know. And so, you know, we had a quote, you know, I'll walk through a lion's cage with pork chop drawers on if it's, if I think I can get to what I'm trying to get to on the other side of it. He wasn't wrong. I mean, I literally lived like less than three miles from the National Klan headquarters.
Wow.
So this 19-year-old kid, and I was they had three other student rangers that had come up, and they all dropped out of the job before they got through midsummer. So they kind of made a big deal out of it. And the regional director, like, he was like, here's my home number. If anything happens, I said, well, I'm going to win him over with my friendly smile and cool demeanor, which I did. But it was work sometimes. It was some wild things going on. That's where I met David Duke for the first time. He had a huge rally going on in right outside the National Park Service headquarters. So, you know, interesting to say the least.
How do you keep a cool demeanor when you're 19 and, you know, the world is still sort of new for you?
Well, that probably helped a lot. Some of the risks I took, I probably wouldn't take today. But I definitely did it then. But also, I felt like exposure was like a lot of what was not happening for young people there, for example. I was the first person outside of their community they'd ever seen. There was a lot of curiosity, but they also had a lot of bad information about who and what things were. And some of my best friends in life they're still right there in the Ozarks. So it was really a kind of dichotomy of what is human archetype. And I realized that pretty early on, like some people are going to hit you and throw all kinds of ignorance your way because of the lack of what they know about things and what they've been taught. And it works both ways. So I just decided that I would really kill them with kindness and be myself. I'm not, and let them know, hey, I'm not really afraid of you in any kind of way, and you shouldn't be afraid of me either. We're like, you know, we're going on this cave tour. It's going to be 5 hours, and 3.5 hours are going to be in a cave, and you best believe your life depends on me. So let's be friends. We can hug early and we can hug afterwards. But if you're going on this cave tour, you're coming with me and you're going to be in my world. So we'll have a good time and we can both like learn to understand. This happened over and over again also because there was a lot of local people who were coming. You know, they had a curiosity about going in the cave and see, like, other than what they do in caves, what happens, you know, in an organized tour or going on a, you know, canoe tour and things like that. And that was like a part of what, when I started creating interpretive programs and, you know, being a guide for people or intro into nature in that way, like the first thing I learned to do was to level off with them on who I was and who they are and how do we negotiate the moment and make it be like a memorable time and hopefully a once in a lifetime moment for both parties. So I learned how to do that pretty quickly. You don't get them all, but I guarantee you I got 90% of the people to like move their radar a bit on like all kinds of things, you know.
It seems to me like you carried an awful lot of wisdom for a 19-year-old.
Hey, I was trying, you know.
So you keep on spending summers with the Park Service through college.
Yeah.
And then what happens is you're getting ready to graduate.
Mm-hmm. Getting ready to graduate, I deciding what I'm going to do. I do, you know, I'm still, you know, have my job as a football player. We do all right with the, you know, the season. Our senior year was good. I ended up being an All-American, you know, playing football, you know, and then we made it into like the national championship, you know, series. And afterwards, I was like, oh, right, let's see, what am I going to do here? I had some options because I had that, been in the program with the National Park Service. And, you know, that program was a really good one because after you graduated, you know, you had an opportunity to accept a job offer from the National Park Service. So they had a 120-day period for you to get offers. And so I had that, but also got offered, you know, like one of these football contracts to play professional football. So I was like, maybe, yeah, you know. And so a bunch of my friends were like, man, are you crazy? You know, you have to do this. I was like, it wasn't really on my list. Like, it wasn't my dream to do that. So I had my dream list and it was, you know, I'd just written it on like a legal pad. Top 10 things I wanted to do in life and the 10 things I wanted nothing to do with. So I ended up, you know, they were like, well, you know, I was on the Buffalo River working and like, well, we're having press day and we need all the folks that are coming in, rookies to come up for, you know, we're going to do a big media blitz on signing your contract. I was like, well, I can't do it on that Saturday because I got a canoe tour. And they were like, are you crazy? I was like, no, I really do. I have a canoe tour. I was like, just put it in the mail, send it to me. I'll sign it and send it right back to you. Which, you know, I was like, no, I got to go canoeing. But they knocked on the ranger's door. You know, I was getting my, the guy comes in with a camera with the mail in his hand. I was like, oh man. So, you know, I'm signing the thing. I'm like, okay, thank you very much. And, but then they wanted to go canoeing with me. So this guy's got his big beta camera. And he's scared to death, but he's covering the gig. And he's like, I was like, well, you got somebody paddle for you? He was like, no, well, I was thinking I would get in the canoe with you. I said, well, you can do it if you want to, but we are going through some rapids. So he got in there with his camera on a, you know, big, that big heavy tripod. And he's sitting in front of me, like facing me the whole time. And I'm canoeing. I mean, it's like 8 miles. And he was like, please don't turn over this, but like, this is my personal camera. There's no way I could ever afford getting another camera like this. I said, well, don't be moving around. And I was like, and you should smile a lot more, because, you know, so, and it was like, the people that were on the tour were like turning over all over the place as we, you know, we'd go through these rapids, but we did not turn over. So it was a hilarious moment.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yes. So you played football?
I did, and I decided, I kind of got midway down through the first season, and I was like, man, everybody has injuries, like serious injuries. So I'm paying attention to this. I started wearing knee braces. I didn't have any trouble with my knees at the time. AstroTurf was really rough, though, at that time in the 80s. I mean, it was just like a piece of shag carpet stretched over some concrete, and that was it. And so, I mean, all the guys had like 10, 12-inch racing stripes on both knees. And I was like, that is something I do not want. And I was like, okay, if I ever get an injury that's like anything serious at all, that's it. I'm going to walk away from this. But then I was also thinking, well, if that gets in your head mentality-wise, like, you're pretty much done. In between that, they had a league called the USFL that popped up, and they were doubling rookies' signing bonus on, you know, like your salary, your NFL salary. So I signed with a team called the Generals. It was Trump's old team.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Anyway, you know, me and three other guys from the Chiefs, we supposedly go up and do this in Atlantic City in the darkness of night. Nobody knows about it, except they have an antitrust suit. And so the USFL sues the NFL and the major networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, for monopolizing professional sports. And they have Howard Cosell as a star witness. And they win the suit. And the judge awarded him $1. And that's when I really learned about, like, how things like that work. Like, they end up with $3. And so my agent calls me one day, we're out on the field. He's like, well, I got some good news and some bad news. I was like, that means it's only bad news. You don't have any good news if it's like, he was like, well, the good news is, you know, he won the suit, but they only got awarded $1. And so I was like, well, that's that. And he was like, and probably someday soon, like within another day or something, they're going to come looking for y'all. And so it was like the next day of practice. It was like, you know, you get an announcement on the loudspeaker. We're out on the, I think we're probably in Arrowhead Stadium at this point for sure, but it's like, you know, Barnes, Oliver Brown, go see the equipment manager. I was like, all right. They were devastated, but I was like, well, that's that. So the one thing that I had done that was good, and the superintendent of Buffalo National River, a guy named Alec Gould, did was when I went up to Kansas City to play football, before I went, he called me in his office and he said, hey, you know, we're hoping you really do great there. But if you decide that that's not something you want to, like, keep doing and, you know, it doesn't work out for you, why don't you consider, like, we can put you on leave without pay, just freeze your status, and you can come back to it. So
great.
I was like, that sounds like a great deal. So the next year, I took him up on that offer. And
how did you end up here in Louisiana?
Well, on my list of places I wanted to work, I had Louisiana down as one of them. I wanted to work with fish, and in wetlands, I had to be around water. I knew that. So I had St. John's Island at the top of my list. They had this 5,000-acre underwater park at the time, and the Bear Terry Preserve in Louisiana, and I had one other spot that was down in the, Puerto Rico had a place, but they didn't. They were kind of developing, and they had El Morro, but, you know, they were considering doing something around the shore. So I really blindfolded myself, and I threw a dart at the map 3 times. Had the old map of the National Park Service, and, you know, I'm kind of looking over there. Guam is over here, and, you know, I'm looking at some different spots, but literally I I did a blindfold dart throw, I think from 15 paces, and I hit New Orleans twice somehow.
That is the universe talking to you.
I didn't have the offer yet. I said, this is what it's going to be. And the next day, I got the call from New Orleans with the offer. I didn't contact them. These are just like places I'm dreaming up. So I learned about how to conjure things up. And 10 days later, I was here. Like, I got the offer. I was here, and I came, showed up the weekend before Mardi Gras. Didn't know anything about that going on at all. In fact, I didn't know what was going on when I got here. The place was upside down. It was on a Sunday, and I was driving in, trying to find the West Bank and, you know, to this new park I'm going to. Got my car packed up, and I just drove right down to the middle of the Treme neighborhood. And it was like people were partying. I stopped to ask directions for the West Bank, and a dude jumped on top of my car and started dancing. And I was like, man, and I jumped. I'm like, what is, you know, and I'm like, what? And so I get directions from him, and I take off driving, and he sends me to Slidell. Right. So I go to Slidell. Oh, yeah. And now I'm in New Orleans for sure. So I get to Slidell, like there was a gas station as soon as you came off the bridge, and these people are like, man, the people in New Orleans are messing with you. It's like, it's completely the opposite direction. So I drive back into town, and I'm like, this makes no sense. I'm looking for the West Bank, and I know West, North, South. I even still had my Silverman compass with me, you know, from the Park Service. And this is how you had to do it back in the day, Caitlin. You know, What? I get lost again. And they gave me the same kind of directions, and I realized this is wrong, but I'm driving the right way, but, you know, everything's flipped around backwards. You learn later. So I finally find the West Bank, and I'm driving over the river, and I get over there, and I can just see people partying, parades everywhere over there. I was like, damn, this is a Sunday. I don't think I can handle New Orleans. And I no clue about Mardi Gras at all until I find the guy's house that was my first supervisor down there. And they are dying laughing because they hear what I tell them what's going on with me. They were like, man, we've been looking for you all day. I was like, yeah, it took me all day to get here.
So how old are you at this point?
Oh, I'm 23.
So 23-year-old you. Mm-hmm. You grew up surrounded by nature, you grew up surrounded by music, mm-hmm. and suddenly you're in this center of both.
Yeah, it's buck wild. It's like, yeah, I just fell off in New Orleans, and, you know, when I got into Barrataria, it was just developing. There was no visitor center or anything. The visitor center was in the back of an empty shell of a, you know, big rig. It was a temporary site. And then, you know, we started creating, you know, interpretive programs. And I was like, well, one thing I want to do for sure is like to create a canoe tour. And this was after being there for a while. I was like, man, the whole park is water. So, and I was like, okay, now how do I do that with these folks around here? Because there was no culture of nobody renting anything. So I went to two guys outside the park and I was like, well, I'm going to do some outreach. And the people in the park thought I was crazy too. I was like, no, I got to go like find out like who lives in around the area. And it was mostly all fishing camps and trappers. And in fact, in the park, we had 99 camps at that time. So all on the water, hunting, fishing, and trapping, and mostly poaching. Sure. South Louisiana, people did whatever they wanted 24/7. So, you know, I went around to two guys and I talked one guy, Tony Ting, I said, hey, man, I'm thinking about starting a canoe tour, and I think you can rent canoes. I can't rent the canoes because, you know, it's a national park and we can't solicit. But if you rent canoe, he was like, do what? I was like, rent canoes. I was like, look, I found four canoes that are in the classified, like Sunday paper, you know. And they were like some old used canoes. And he was like, now, why would I try and rent a canoe? Nobody uses it. I talked him into buying two canoes. And then I had to have another person. So, you know, I got to have, it can't be one person doing it. So I talked to another guy, Earl. We had a bar right outside the park. And Earl was like, man, this is, I ain't never heard nobody talking about doing that like that. I said, just try it. You know, so we tried and, you know, they rent out their two canoe. Look, they bought the canoes for $75 and they make $75 the first day they have them. So he was like, well, if it's that easy, you know, I was like, yeah, I was like, you know, you can't like, you know, like come in the park trying to rent the canoes. All you need is your phone number. And they were literally right outside the park's boundary. I was like, put your phone number for the bar. They'll come and pick up the canoes. And Tony was across the street. So he created a place called the Bayou Barn from it. And he immediately, like, he just dove into it and started, you know, having dances with music in the whole nine yards and renting canoes. And that's how it took off. And it was local people. And then someone from the New York Times contacted me and they wanted to go on a canoe tour. And when they did that, that was like, that's what flipped it. I booked a whole year and like one day, the next, they came out on a Sunday on the full moon or Saturday night. And the Sunday article came out Monday morning. I've got people from all over the world calling. And so, and I didn't know that at that time, but, you know, New York Times is like syndicated with like 140 countries. So, you know, people everywhere would, you know, like they pick up that article. And then it was in the in-flight magazines for like Continental Airlines and, you know, Southwest, and they all have to do the same thing. So
it's worth pausing here, I think, because when people think of national parks, they think of arches. They think of these enormous landform, southwestern,
big sky parks.
Mm-hmm. This is something real different.
Totally different. Yeah.
And we'll be heading out there later, but I was hoping you could kind of paint a visual picture of what Barataria looks like.
The Barataria unit of Jean Lafitte National Park is, it's about 32,000 acres of wetlands, bottomland hardwood forests, palmetto groves, but it's about 85% in the water. So it's a very reflective of southeast Louisiana. It's very old spaces where people have lived. Also, if you go into Lafitte, there's places that are like 2,500-year-old burial grounds from, you know, Native American people. But it's where everybody kind of converged, and the park ends up being named after Jean Lafitte himself, the privateer, the body smuggler. He and his brother Dominic Yeo are kind of running a lot of commerce. People, they're still smuggling people in. They're basically into the city after emancipation or before it, and then all during this time period. So they're kind of combating what's going on the East Coast, basically. In the Carolinas, this is what flips the whole economy and concept of what America is, because Charleston was like the center of where people were being brought in from different parts of Africa and other goods that are coming in. But this place down here at the mouth of the river is like this kind of old ancient place that everything goes, and you can come in with a boatload of pink elephants if you want to. Nobody's saying anything. So that's kind of what New Orleans is, and it's the gateway more so than a lot of other places into Central and South America, but it's also extremely attractive to people coming from Europe. So it has this mystique that's been here for a really long time, much larger than the actual physical space that we know is like pretty small, but has a huge, you know, storyline and folklore around all kinds of things, and they're all true. That's the other part of it. So, you know, it's around music and it's food, and it's just a place of otherness that people come to or were born into, and within 24 minutes, you can be out into these wild places in a national park outside the city. So,
So when we first talked, you told me this really lovely story of one full moon night and you in the park and your harmonica and some frogs and alligators. And I was hoping you might just share that story.
Frogs and alligators. Okay. I'm reeling back to see what it was. It was probably me out canoeing.
Yeah,
you were. Yeah, well, I used to go out by myself a lot, and I still do. Yeah, I don't mind like going out at 2 o'clock in the morning in the woods, and that's what I was doing when I was a child. I would roll out of the bedroom window and go out in the woods and climb in a tree when I was 10 years old and just sit and watch and see what was going on. It was all kinds of things. But yeah, harmonica was like one of those instruments that I would play, and it started attracting alligators, first of all. Love it. They just swim. When they hear it, they come right to it. So I was sitting out in a canoe in this Coquille, Bayou Coquille, playing, and like 10 alligators, all over 10 feet, just came right to the canoe. And they just sat there the whole time. I was like, wow, this is a trip. So that's kind of when I started thinking to myself also about giving, you know, like having other people be able to experience like what this is, since they might not believe it unless they're like actually in it and doing it. So
I have a lump in my throat and tears in my eyes. Sunpie, that is, that's so stirring.
Well, that's kind of what, you know, it was, my father used to play harmonica, and I'd like get his harp and sit on his knee and he'd play that. And I was like, wow, where's this magic coming from? You know, and so, you know, I thought when I got older, I wanted to make some magic, you know, and that's what I kind of considered music, you know.
If I were an alligator, I would be totally hanging out at that boat.
Yeah. And the mosquitoes, don't forget the morning wire. They showed up too.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're becoming a musician.
Yeah, you know.
The big city.
In New Orleans, this was like a playground for all those things. You know, working in the wetlands. I was living on the West Bank, and I was down in Barataria living there for a while, and then I decided I would move up to Tarrytown. But every night I would just like crawl through the hundreds of bars and saloons in New Orleans because the music was there. Everybody was around, you know, Ernie Cato, Fats Domino, you know, I'd go by his house. He's like one of the few people I would call in sick to work, because Fats would be like, I mean, he would call you at like 2 o'clock in the morning. He was a musician, you know. He'd be like, hey, what you doing in the morning? I'd be like, I don't know. I'm thinking, I got to get up at 6 o'clock and go to work. He'd be like, I'm going to hardware store. You want to go? Yeah, I do want to go. So I got to like leave this message and go to the hardware store with Fats Domino and Chalmette. And he would like, you know, he'd go through this through the hardware store, not buy a single thing. Just take 2 hours and walk through it. But before he went, he would put on a big giant pot. I mean, a gigantic pot of red beans and rice, something like that. And it would cook for like 3 or 4 hours. And he'd come back, play piano. He loved Heineken's. So he would drink a few beers and just hang out with him, you know, all day. And that was it, you know. And then I was like, wow, that was my sick leave went to a good place, you know. You're like, you're earning your, when you first start working for the federal government, like you only get 4 hours of sick leave, like per pay period, you know. So you got to like stockpile those Fats Domino moments.
How do you go from being this young guy stockpiling his Fats Domino moments to a band leader?
Well, I thought I was like crawling through it pretty slow, but now that I look back on it, I might have been, I mean, I was just having fun. I was kind of sitting in, you know, a lot of different bands, and people like Jay Munkadee would, he was a harmonica player. He was like, oh, come on, son, you're going to come play with us. And, you know, I was hanging out at a lot of bars. So people in New Orleans are very open and extremely welcoming. And they would be like, come on, let me see what you got. You know, so I was playing. I had a band with Barbara George, who was R&B. A singer and had some hit records. We had a band called the Down Home Blues Band. It was a wonderful, incredible band. The bass player from Little Richard's old band and Jimmy Reed's second guitar player, all these folks were in that band. So we just played around bars and everything. And we were in some tough places too, Jack. I mean, all over. This city was like just incredible for bars. It was a good 200 bars that you could go in, you know, in live music every night. Didn't matter what night it was. I started trying to figure out some places where I thought we could make more than $35 a night. I thought I was being greedy, but it was just facts, you know. So I was like, well, we're going to try the Maple Leaf. We're going to go uptown to the Maple Leaf. They were like, Maple Leaf. And so, you know, some of them knew the place because, Barbara knew it because James Booker played in there and some different people. These were all like friends of hers. So, you know, we started playing in there, and the guy who was booking the bands, John Parsons, he just basically entrusted me. So kind of put together another little combination on a Sunday night. We go in there and play, and that's really how I kind of started getting experience managing a bunch of wild people, which meant, like, you're the youngest. You do all the hustling. You know what I mean, Caitlin? Go do this, go do that. So I was doing that at the same time in New Orleans as I was like getting in my little Chevy Love truck. And actually it was a Ford Ranger. And I would drive to Lake Charles, or I would go to Opelousas, or I'd go to Eunice just in the middle of the night, get back home a few minutes before I had to go to work. But I'd go and listen to Zydeco bands like that. And I started playing with Furnace Arsenault and his band, and he was from the Lafayette area, but he lived outside of Lafayette in a little place there that was probably about 15 miles from there, Leonville and Catahoula, and the little township of Catahoula. And, you know, I was playing in that band with those guys, and it was about a 10-piece band. Everybody in the band spoke Creole, and playing with Barbara and her band, and then I decided I would try and combine that concept of those things. So in 1990, I started a band with Sun Pine, the Louisiana Sunspots, kind of kicked it off. Got a lot of great help from Harold Brown, who's the drummer from the band War. So Harold helped me put the band together, actually, and understand a lot around music and music business, especially. Like, how do you do it? And when I recorded my first record, Harold helped me do that. First three records, actually. So we were great friends. He was a great mentor for me, weaving through it and trying to figure out, like, what do you do after you make your record? You know, you got it. Now what you going to do with it? And we got lucky. Harold had some good connections, but he was also like, he was like, well, what do you want to do with the music? I was like, well, I want it to be in, like, movies and in film and things like that. So we went for that aspect of it, and it miraculously worked out. I think they had its first record called Lugaroo and, like, 16 different film, you know, I'm talking like Hollywood films, started picking up the music, so I was kind of embarrassed at first because it was like my first CD. I was like, I know I could have played better than that. Now. But they liked it, so I had to stop asking questions and just like roll with it. And, you know, and from there we did another one. And that's kind of how, you know, I became a, you know, band leader. And I was definitely somehow always the youngest one in the band. But, you know, that's how it unfolded. And started playing in Europe and playing in the Caribbean and, you know, all kinds of places, Central America, South America, you know, Africa. Never had an agent or a manager, really, or anything like that. Just
you play with Paul Simon, you play with Sting.
Mm-hmm.
And all this time, you're still at the National Park Service.
100%. Yeah. Except for the days when Fats wanted to go to the hardware store.
Which is totally reasonable.
Yeah.
So there's this moment where you take a new job, like late 90s, early aughts, with this very new type of national park.
Yeah. New Orleans Jazz and a great musician here in town, Danny Barker, kind of put that bug in my ear back in about 1991 or two. They had a festival that started in Lafayette Park, and it was, it was called Jeff Fest, and Danny was there, and I knew him because I would see him playing, and he was like this really famous guitar player. He played with everybody from Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, he's like the most recorded string player in jazz, period. But, he would talk to me and stuff. He was always encouraged me. He was like, hey, Ranger. And when I were at the festival, he said, you still out there hugging them trees and roping alligators? And I was like, yes, sir. He was like, I want you to come downtown and meet me, and I want to show you something. So I came and met him, and he took me down to what was called the Old U.S. Mint. Took me up on the second floor, and on the second floor, they had an exhibit, and it was just like, and it was archival instruments. Everybody's instrument, all these famous jazz musicians who had kind of pioneered the music, from Jelly's piano, Sidney Bechet's horn, Louis Armstrong's cornet, everybody. He was like, when you get tired of hugging them trees, why don't you come downtown? And he said, we need a national park about jazz music. So I'm inviting you to leave them gators and come downtown with the sharks. And so, and I was like, okay, I was intrigued by it because he said it. And 3 or 4 years later, there was a national park that called New Orleans Jazz in 1994. They passed this legislation to create that park. And 1999, I decided to come downtown with the Sharks.
So it seems to me that in some fundamental way, in all your work, in your music work, in your work out in Barataria, you are a conservationist. You are preserving what makes this place special. And what makes this place special is in the palmettos, it's in the wetlands, and it's in the music. And somehow it feels like it's all connected.
It's definitely connected. And I never really tried to separate anything out that I thought was like good about it, but just like circle my wagons around it and see how I could be in the middle of it and or help it keep doing what it's doing. Not really trying to change things or anything like that, but make people more aware of it, like people in cities more aware of like how special, the surrounding wetlands are for them. And a lot of people do know it, but just like remind them like this is for everybody. Same thing with the music. Like the music, the spirit of the music that comes out of New Orleans is like miraculously traveled around the world. And it's helped people to find a balance and see themselves beyond all kinds of barriers. And think that like they can create their own voices through this. Same thing in the wetlands. I have people get them in the woods or get them into nature, period, long enough to where they can relax and like let go of all that nervous urban tension. And it usually takes a minute for them to do that, but to where they can be comfortable enough to see themselves as a part of the universe and a part of the planet itself and know that everything should be on an even playing field. So I'm always trying to think of ways to have people realize that and be okay with it. You don't need to manipulate it 1,000 ways. You need to be a part of it. Understand that being a human, like any other animal, when I'm crawling around with fungi, I'm going to be down on my hands and knees and on my belly because I'm going to be eye level with what's going on. It's me It's some 500-pound hog, and we're both looking at the same mushroom. It's a wild moment. It's going to happen. Now, who flinches first is, you know, it's going to be interesting, and it's true. I mean, there's nothing like being down, crawling around, you're photographing, you know, something, and it's just like, I feel eyes on me. And you don't know where they are yet, and I mean, that hog is just lying there silent. And as soon as your eyes, if you start scanning the area and your eyes cross theirs, before you really see them, they just jump straight up and scream like a wild hog. And they'll charge and cut off from you, or they'll turn around and they'll run about 30 yards and they stop. And then they turn around and they get down and they crawl behind you and get on the backside of you. And when you start moving, they just follow you. And it's like, it's a trip. You know, it'd be like 500 or 600-pound hog. And that's what they do. So it's like understanding nature and like your place in it is like, I just try and always remind people, like, the best thing to do is be humble as possible and realize, like, you know, where we are in the world. And it's good to hold on to these special things that are like going on and try and protect them. You know, if you look at the news from yesterday and the legislation of what's going on with the coastal restoration and the Barataria project, $618 million being wiped out with no real reasoning other than ignorance, and we're just going to grab this money. The money was already designated. It's happening. It doesn't take anything from anybody's taxes. Lord knows we pay a lot of taxes, but the tax base is not changing. And 46% of the tax base in Louisiana is in Orleans Parish. And so it's always the entities often outside of this cityscape that want to make the money grab, and having people understand that like this belongs to everybody. Without coastal restoration, definitely we are in the fastest eroding landscape on the planet. And it's happening rapid fire. At some point, you have to fight for to write to have people understand how ignorance and short-sightedness this will happen. Now, when I moved here, I was hearing a lot of same things. In fact, the data needs to be really updated and have people understand it's much faster than it used to be. And it's like there is no real future for future generations of people to be living in this space. And it's a very special place. It's been 20 years since Katrina happened. And, you know, there was some tough, hard times that happened in New Orleans. And now it's pretty much around the world. The world has come to the New Orleans experience, and it didn't really have to.
So I've been thinking about all this a lot. Louisiana is eroding, yes. And the people who are most vulnerable are the people whose homes are closest to the bleeding edge of Louisiana. And as Louisiana disappears, the wetlands that protect the whole southern part of the state from hurricanes are there, and there's no protection, and it becomes an escalating cycle. And we're in a political climate that's not particularly sympathetic to that reality.
No.
And at the same time, cultures erode. They erode partly because of mass culture, a commercial culture. They erode partly because of xenophobia. They erode partly because of the homogeneity of what people consume. And you are still actively working to preserve both the natural environment and the cultural one. As you think about your role in helping preserve all this, What impels you forward? What gives you hope?
Well, you know, when I came into this environment, when I, you know, started to work and become a part of the communities that are around here, you know, it just gave me a sense of the importance of and uniqueness, actually, in this particular area of how well people have created survival skills over the years. And, you know, when I leave here and go out into other parts of the world, for whatever reason it is, it just becomes more apparent that, especially around the continental 48 states in the U.S., that, yeah, a lot of things are homogenized in different ways, but this is still a place where community organizing, the preservation of culture is done with the least amount of financial wealth and goods. It's not like we have fantastic arts programs all over the city of New Orleans in every public school or private school, but they are here. But it's actually in the communities that the people still do it. And they do it in a miraculous way. It's done by spirit and effort that has not that much to do with, you know, monetary gain or anything like that. It's not about that. It's how people learn to survive. It's how they survived moving to this country from other spaces to try and build a new home. It's how they survive being, you know, captured and brought here in a way. And it's the same way that people come here with what's known as the American dream to try and become a part of something, but also to create a platform for knowledge of tradition for future generations of people. That's real preservation. I don't have a separation in me as a person between, you know, trying to sustain coastal wetlands, trying to sustain fisheries, trying to sustain culture. I might be on a few too many boards right now, but I'm on them because it's around the passion of preservation around the natural world and around cultural things. I'm still a big chief in the Northside Skull and Bone Gang. You know, this is an old tradition in New Orleans that's been around and came out of, you know, enslaved African males trying to say on Carnival Day, Mardi Gras Day, that I'm actually a human and I'm going to self-validate and show you who I am. And in Social Agent Pleasure Club, like the Black Man of Labor, dedicated to traditional music and dance and funeral rites. This is so, and we do it for our communities. It's for the communities of people around us in all those ways, just trying to create something that's like good to remind people. And if you don't know, give them a good guide to be able to do it. So, you know, you might not get paid back and like monetary gain or something like that, but you are going to help to sustain infrastructure and in different ways. And that's in people's hearts and their minds and the knowledge of understanding how important it is to be like a full human and have the ability to create things and to hold and sustain things, no matter how difficult it may seem. We are in some difficult times now. But, you know, I come from a lot of people who had nothing. They didn't have the opportunity at all. They tried to make a pathway for like us, you know, they definitely taught us that no matter how we think about it, we're walking on the shoulders of giants. So that's, you know, some of the things I've done, like with this kind of work, with this book around Creole language and culture and those things like that. You know, it's just about being able to pass that knowledge on the music, the stories, the things that were like given to me, to people who were like so kind to me and took the time out to show me what was going on in this area that I'm in and around other parts of the world. Also, that's one of the main reasons I love playing music is to be able to go out into the world and connect culturally with other people and have people understand like where real joy comes from, you know. So you have to like clear the space and create the infrastructure in your own psyche, in your own heart, And you can get it maybe in a 10-second sound bite, but you can't sustain it unless you do it yourself. So it's around being able to do those things yourself and then pass along. The spirit transfer is a real thing.
That feels like a beautiful stopping place. But before we stop, let me ask you, is there anything that we have not talked about that you want to share?
We could talk until the cows come home.
I know.
But no, I think, you know, obviously you're super pro at what you do. So that's good. I mean, you know, there's always things that could happen. But, you know, this is good. And it's, you know, it's a bit off the, it's not the same old canned kind of stuff that happens, you know.
Yeah, we don't want the canned stuff.
No.
I am so looking forward to seeing you perform this evening at Chickiwawa.
Yeah, well, we're going to be in there.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for showing up and bringing your team with you and coming, you know, in the cool days of July. This is good. Last year, it was so hot that it was, you know, it was pretty unbearable. It was probably 110 or 12 degrees on a day like this with the humidity with it also, you know, so pushing 120 with the heat index.
Well, that makes this afternoon frosty.
Breezy and easy, I say.
Thanks for tuning in to Still Here, a series produced by A Piece of My Mind. I'm John Noltner, the founder and director of A Piece of My Mind. Be sure to visit our website, listed in the episode notes, to see photos and video from this story. This series is produced with interview help from journalist Barry Yeoman, editing help from summer interns Kate West, Sawyer Garrison, and Caitlin Emai, and audio production by Rosic Saifullah.